Welcome to the Jig Is Up podcast with your hosts, Darcy and Jason. The Jig Is Up is recorded on the traditional lands of the Blackfoot Confederacy, as well as the lands of Treaty Six Nations. We aim to bring you new perspectives and open up conversations about Métis politics, culture, and current events, as well as stories that affect Indigenous from all over. If you like the show, or you don't, or if you want to send us suggestions for guests or topics to discuss on the show, feel free to email us at metispodcast@gmail.com. And be sure to follow us on all of the social media at Métis Podcast. All right, well, welcome to the Jig Is Up. My name is Darcy, and today I have an amazing guest with me, Caitlin McCarthy. So welcome to the show, Caitlin.
Thank you for having me, Darcy. I'm really excited to be here.
So we were talking a little bit before the podcast here about your Métis roots. So I thought we'd start there and just maybe tell us a little bit about how you reconnected, why you reconnected, and I guess what that means to you.
Yeah, that'd be great. Well, first of all, I'm Métis through my mom's ancestry. Her maiden name is Arsenault, which for many listeners, they may recognize that as a Acadian last name. But she also had ancestors who were in Quebec. And we happen to be direct descendants of Marie-Olivier Silvestre and Martin Prevost. And my apologies if I'm slaughtering names. I'm an English speaker. I sadly, as an American, and I just want to throw that in, I am an American. I didn't really take French class.
So that's okay. We won't hold it against you. I'm not good at French either.
Yeah, you're more than welcome to correct me. but we are direct descendants of them, which is the first recorded official marriage between, and we use the word, by the way, for Indigenous Native. So if anyone hears me using that word, I'm not being insulting. That's just how we refer to people.
Yeah, that's fine.
But it's the first marriage between a Native person and, I believe, a French person in Canada. So we had heard stories, my sister and I, and my mother as well, from my great aunt when my sister and I were growing up. And we were always fascinated by, Acadia. We talk about Evangeline, the poem by Longfellow, who actually lived in Massachusetts, which is where I'm from.
Nice.
And we also heard that there was Native ancestry, but we were told that many people in our tree covered that up because of the massive discrimination that took place. And I just want to mention, it wasn't just the Natives who were discriminated against in Massachusetts, but also the Acadians who came down to settle here, and the French Canadians as well. To totally sidetrack for a second, one of my great grandmothers, Natalie LeBlanc, went after the Great Expulsion in 1755 from Acadia. She came down here with her family, and the discrimination was so bad they actually left Massachusetts and went back home.
Oh,
they
wow.
figured it was better there than here. And it wasn't until the 1800s that David Arsenault came down with his wife and settled in Worcester, Massachusetts, which is where I'm from. But as you can see, I love history. I love learning about my family. I love the personal stories. I'm a storyteller. You know, I write screenplays. So I love finding out, you know, who, what, where, when, why, and how, if possible.
Yeah.
One of the things that when my grand aunts were telling the stories, they didn't have all the details. And it was really the internet that changed everything for us. My sister and I were able to start diving in and doing research on our own. There was absolutely no way that we could have afforded a genealogist to go digging in all the multiple different places that we had to go. And also, it took a little time because we didn't speak French. Although I must have taught myself because I'm actually able to read some documents now and understand what's going on. So I'm very proud of myself. And I sometimes feel so badly for my French ancestors. Like, I'm sorry, I just speak English. But anyway, I will learn French someday, I promise. But we were able, through Ancestry.com especially, to get our hands on the documents, birth certificates, death certificates, marriage certificates, written letters, things like that. Mm. So it just verified everything that my great aunts had told us. And it was thrilling. It was very thrilling to find out who these people were, to put a name to the stories. And one thing that we had talked about before the interview started, every writer, and as a writer myself, we all have a theme that we seem to be exploring all the time in our work. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's the theme of identity. I've always been fascinated by that. You know, what makes you tick? What makes you who you are? So, I mean, my Métis heritage is the ultimate search for identity. You know, who are we? Because of where I live, We don't have a Métis community. So we really have been cut off from our history, the culture. And, you know, that saddens me, but I'm excited to reconnect with it.
Right on. And so I'm assuming shortly thereafter you had took out a membership with the Métis Federation of Canada. Was that part of kind of just confirming that this, your information was right, or what was was the goal there?
We actually knew the information was right because we had it verified. Ontario Métis Family Records Center. When I learned about the Métis Federation of Canada, I was really excited about their mission. I think it's wonderful, their message of unity and being inclusive. Mm-hmm. And that's something that attracted me. I didn't want to be surrounded by infighting and negativity. I wanted to learn more about my identity. I wanted to, you know, embrace the culture. Something I always stress, because in the United States, you know, race, identity, very sensitive subjects. We saw that play out with Elizabeth Warren. You saw that on the presidential level, but that was even happening when she was running for senator in Massachusetts. It really came back to haunt her that she had been checking the box and claiming to be Native American. And she had heard stories, but she didn't have any type of documentation at all. And she was claiming in interviews that she was Cherokee in Delaware. I have no idea where she heard those things, but she took the stories from her family as truth, and it blew up on her. Mm-hmm. So I'm very careful. You know, I don't claim to be a Métis. I always say I'm of Métis descent, and that's not to be insulting to anybody who does say they are Métis. It's just I'm very careful with, you know, I just want to know more about my identity and my history. Mm-hmm. And where I don't have a community here to connect with, I just feel a little strange, you know, claiming to be something that, you know, it's still something I'm discovering, you know, all the details. We had heard about it, but now I'm learning more about it.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's a great point to make, because I think, like we were talking about too, you know, I think you can get painted with, oh, you just want to get something out of this. But I think for most people that I've talked to, it's really about connecting and reconnecting to who you are.
Yes. Yes. I mean, I have no desire to go hunting or fishing. Camping has always been my nightmare. I just don't want to do it. I'm all set with my education. I'm not looking for scholarships. I know there are certain prizes for Métis artists, and I hope those prizes go to people who are Métis. Mm-hmm. I'm all set. You know, Caitlin McCarthy in Massachusetts is all set. It's the best place to be, you know, someone with an Irish name. But it really is.
Yeah.
And I'm burning on the beach. You know, I'm not experiencing prejudice. So I never want to muscle in on opportunities, benefits, rights that belong to people who are Métis. Because I am aware, even though many of the issues about that's going on with the Métis people don't get reported in the United States. On my own, I have learned about the issues. Mm-hmm. We do have a similar issue happening here with our reservations, where Native girls are disappearing and nobody's finding out why, who's doing this. The crimes that are committed against people of Native background, that's disgusting. And that's happening up in Canada as well. So, you know, I'm very sensitive to the issues. So I never want to hone in on someone else's world. You know, I just want to find out more about my identity myself.
Yeah, absolutely. So now you're a writer, you're a screenwriter. Has this kind of boiled over into your writing at all, or in ways that maybe you were surprised by, or just ideas that you had, or?
Yes, actually, one of my screenplays is a thriller entitled A Native Land. It's about a Black Native American. She is actually Wampanoag in the screenplay. She's a cop battling local prejudice, personal troubles in her own police force while trying to find a serial killer on Cape Cod.
Oh, wow.
Some of the issues that are happening to the Wampanoag, specifically the Mashpee Wampanoag on Cape Cod, are similar to what's happening to Métis up in Canada. The Trump administration, I can't speak, I'm sorry, just recently decided that they're going to take away the land of the Mashpee Wampanoag. They were revoking the reservation status. So they're taking away 321 acres of land out of federal trust.
Wow.
Which takes away their ability to govern on their own land. And something that I'm sure you know, it's not just about, you know, casinos on these, you know, and they don't have a casino, by the way. But it's, some people think, oh, reservation casino. You know, this is their land, and this is where people receive health services, where they attend, you know, language immersion school, and this is where they celebrate their culture.
Yep.
Taking away their land is horrifying. Something a lot of people can or may not realize is that the tribes in the United States are struggling to maintain less than 5% of all lands in the U.S. That they had before European contact.
Wow.
That's not much.
No, it isn't.
So, you know, it's just, you have to wonder why, especially during, you know, the coronavirus pandemic, why now to take away the land from the Mashpee Wampanoag? Thankfully, people are fighting back. But what concerns me is this could be a signal of what's to come for other tribes.
Absolutely.
We don't know. But to get back to my screenplay, all this happened long after I finished writing my screenplay. But A Native Land, a lot of the action in the story centers around conservation land, the woods, that the town owns. And there are people being killed, the homeless people who are living in the conservation land. And Roxanne, who is the lead, the Black Native American cop, she's investigating it. And she's the one that starts realizing that there's a pattern. But her police force doesn't believe it. In a way, it doesn't want to believe it because it will scare away tourism. It will upset, you know, the well-to-do people who have second homes in that village. Also, the land has been, in the screenplay, a point of a controversy because at one point it did belong to the Wampanoag. And so the Wampanoag tribe wants it back. So you can see where Roxanne is trapped between two worlds. You know, she wants to do right by her people, but she also wants to do a good job on the police force. And I explored the theme of identity. And I also think about, you know, connectivity in the community, you know, that we all really should be united, coming together, but there's so many little things that drive us apart. And sometimes the word Native land, the Native is a play on words because obviously she's of Native descent, but the people who are locals in the screenplay view themselves as Natives, locals, townies of the Cape. So the word is interchangeable, you know, depending on whether it's the lowercase N or the capital N.
Yeah,
are
right.
Are you local Native or are you the Native?
Wow, that's a real play on the big M, little M, Métis issue. So that's interesting. Yeah.
Oh, I know. I discovered that one too. Every once in a while, I'll run into an internet troll, and you know, it's interesting being here in the United States. I don't have any claim to anything that, you know, by saying I'm of Métis descent, you know, even if I said I am Métis, I'm in the United States. Like, I'm not joining anything. I'm not getting anything. Like, calm down. It still upsets people for me to even put a capital M when I'm talking about it.
Yeah.
And the irony is my eighth grade grandparents are the topic of a book. I think it's volume 3 of First Métis Families of Quebec. So, it's kind of obvious that I am who I say I am, but there are people who would argue that I'm not who I say I am. And again, that's why I love this theme of identity. You know, who decides?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it someone else or is it you?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I actually spoke to somebody once, and one of the things they said was every single person, the biggest issue that people face is identity. And I kind of thought, I don't know if that's true. But then the more I thought about it, the more it really kind of does seem that way because, and I, you know, I'm not talking like troubles like coronavirus and financial troubles, but I mean like just within yourself, I think a lot of people have some sort of an identity issue that they are trying to work through. This
Absolutely.
Just happens to be, you know, ours, and it's, you know, common or not a common one, but, you know, there's lots of people with this same issue as far as Métis and identity, but I think it applies to a lot of people. So I think that identity issue is a very important topic to kind of start hitting on.
Well, I mean, I even see it I call it my survival job. I teach English at an inner city public high school, and we have some transgender students. And, you know, we handle them with care because there are people who are trying to deny them of their identity. You know, they may have been born one gender, but they, you know, a phrase that we use is like boy parts, girl heart, and vice versa. And there are people who refuse to use the name that they would like to go by.
Yeah.
And that's so disrespectful because that's their identity. And
exactly.
So we have that debate unfolding in this country. We even will sometimes hear, you know, well, you're Black, but you're not Black, you know, or you're Jewish, but you're not my kind of Jewish, or you're Christian, but you're not my kind of Christian.
Yeah.
And we can just pick on everybody. The nitpicking has got to stop. And again, you know, and it might sound a little Pollyannish, but the more the merrier. It's like people like, for example, the Métis, like you're proud of it. You celebrate it. I mean, why would you turn someone who thinks you're awesome away?
Yeah.
You know? Wouldn't you want like more people to join your party? You know, and especially, you know, where, you know, they have the ancestry
mm-hmm.
and they recognize themselves as being Métis. You should want them on board. And this is something that attracted me to the Métis Federation of Canada, is that it recognizes that people had to move sometimes for survival, that you lose, because the Métis people are, you know, mobile. And sometimes you can't always stay in one spot. I mean, look at all the people today who have to relocate for jobs to, you know, eat, to have a roof over their head. And especially back then, I mean, it was not that difficult to lose touch with your community.
Oh, for sure.
And should that be held against you that, you know, I mean, what if, you know, I mean, or like, what if you, in past podcasts, I heard someone talking about someone's ancestors were in one spot for like 6 months. And because of that, they are recognized, okay, you are Métis, but other people in the family who weren't there, no, you're not.
Yes.
It doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
No. So like essentially like your zip code is determining this.
Exactly. Well, and that's the thing.
I don't get it.
And you know, honestly, I mean, if you look at the reality of it is, if there hadn't have been all the government interventions to try to eliminate people's identities, I mean, where would we be at today? I mean, if Acadia hadn't got expelled in 1755 and they had been able to, you know, grow and flourish and stay there, we'd have a very, mm-hmm. very different history and world right now.
Oh, I wouldn't exist.
Right
there, it'd be very different.
Exactly.
Yes, it's true.
So but I just, you know, I always think about that when I think like all these people fighting about this. I'm like, but you don't understand how much effort the governments, you know, British, French, or whoever, US and Canada now, put in, how much effort mm-hmm. they're putting in to eliminate identity. I mean, in 2020, you're talking about, you know, an Indigenous group or Native group losing their land still. Like, they're still doing it.
Yes. And I mean, it doesn't take a brain surgeon to figure out why it's happening on the Cape. I mean, property is limited.
Yeah.
And you can make, you know, millions upon millions of dollars on 321 acres of land. Yeah. I mean, Mashpee is a beautiful area. You've got the ocean nearby. You can have all the clam bakes you want, you know,
right.
And they have golf courses and, you know, have a ball. And you're probably thinking of all the McMansions that can be built
Absolutely.
On this land.
Yeah.
That does not belong to them. You know, it belongs to the Mashpee Wampanoag, but they're trying to take it away from them.
Well, and I always think, wrong. Like, let's think about that. Like, if they, let's say they're successful and they take away that land. Now let's fast forward eight generations. How strong is their cultural tie going to be without that land, without that connection anymore? Like you're
exactly,
you know, so eight generations from now, are people going to be fighting with them saying, oh, you never were Native? Like,
and the tragedy is the Mashpee Wampanoag have lived on Cape Cod for like about 10,000 years.
Yeah.
Like, and that's not hyperbole. That's exactly how long they've lived there.
Yeah.
And at one point, you know, they were, you know, as many as 40,000. And now there's about 4,000 to 5,000.
Wow.
In New England. So, you know, the numbers have dwindled. And something that they've made a great effort about is, you know, teaching the culture, teaching the language, really, mm-hmm. you know, embracing their heritage. But you're right. If they are deprived of their land, where are they going to go? I mean, because there are, you know, places, you know, like in Martha's Vineyard, you know, that they could maybe go there. But I mean, again, it's not their land. That's, you know, the Akina. It's not the Mashpee Wampanoag.
Yeah.
So it's just... It's very sad, especially when you think that the Wampanoag were the very first tribe that the Mayflower Pilgrims encountered when they arrived Plymouth Rock. And if it weren't for the Wampanoags, the Pilgrims wouldn't have made it.
Mm.
And sometimes I laugh and say, maybe that wouldn't have been such a bad thing. But But even Plymouth Plantation, which is a historical site that you can visit, and they recreate what life would have been like, you know, during that time period, the Wampanoags had to fight for representation at Plymouth Plantation. And because they weren't being represented at all. It's like, oh no, the Pilgrims did all by themselves. And they finally were able to get representation there. But I remember as a little girl, there being protests outside of Plymouth Plantation around Thanksgiving. And I thought that was a perfect time to protest because it drove home the point. Yeah, you're celebrating Thanksgiving, but it, you know, hello, you know, you're leaving us out. So it's unfortunate. But yeah, people seem to always be fighting over identity, aren't they?
Well, and it is, and especially I think what's really hard about this for myself and for a lot of folks is, like, there's been so much, I guess, trauma and hurt and pain involved in all of these, you know, expulsions and land removals and just moving people and you know, the residential schools or the industrial schools, whatever, boarding schools, all these things kind of, they did a lot of trauma and damage. And so when people are starting to reconnect, I think that's a positive sign. I think that's wonderful to see people starting to break through that, to connect with who they are again. And then you have these people that are fighting against it. And I don't understand why you would want to inflict more pain on people who are simply trying to get answers. Because my family was like yours, where they hid it. I mean, even to today, most of my family won't admit that they have any mixed blood at all. And that's fine, but that's a, you know, it's a lie, essentially, right? But it was survival at one point. So I get why they said, no, we're totally white. Yep, you betcha.
Yes, I mean, yes, if it meant, because again, in Massachusetts, if you were of a certain religion, certain background, forget it. You were not getting hired at all, even if you were the most qualified. And people don't think of liberal Massachusetts as being that way, but it was, and sometimes it still is.
Yeah.
You know, we still have controversies about the reservations and the casinos and people getting bent out of shape over it. And, you know, why are the natives getting something and we're not? And you just pause and think, are you seriously asking that question?
Yeah.
You have to ask. You know, again, I go back to, you know, they have less than 5% of all lands of the U.S. that once belonged to them.
Exactly.
And you're wondering why do they get to do what they like on their reservation? Because it's their land.
Yeah.
So yes, it's fascinating to me. But again, I don't understand why somebody who's truly in earnest, you know, reconnecting with their past, something that was hidden, you know, kept from them, why that's held against them when it's through no fault of their own. That's like saying to somebody who was adopted and discovered who their biological parents were, well, you know, yes, biologically these are your parents, but we want nothing to do with you.
Yeah.
You know, and it's hurtful.
It is.
It's hurtful.
Absolutely.
And again, with, you know, regard to the Métis, there are many people who do not want anything for it, just other than acceptance and identity, you know, like having, being acknowledged and recognized, yes, you are who you feel you are and who you say you are.
Yeah.
And who you can prove you are.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, that's the irony of it all, that people can prove this. It's not something that you heard from your grandmother. Like, if you have the, you know, the documentation that shows, yes, here's the direct line.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how can you then say to the person, well, you know, sorry, still not good enough for me. You know, they moved. So it doesn't matter.
They moved somewhere in the last 500 years, so they don't qualify now.
Yeah, you weren't allowed to move. Did you miss that memo?
Yeah.
No moving. No.
Oh, my
stay,
God.
Stay still. it makes no sense.
Well, it doesn't
because,
either.
I mean,
no.
Well, I mean, you know, because you could always throw out, you know, Riel, you know, his father, he moved, didn't he? So is he still, you know, Métis?
Well, exactly.
He wasn't.
Yeah.
He wasn't from where, you know, he's supposed to be originally. So how is he Métis and other people aren't?
Exactly. No, I always kind of laugh because if you look at the way, you know, obviously, you know, the East Coast was where people were first starting to land. And then as they colonized the land, it slowly moved westward. And then it's like, you know, why I've never understood why these nationalists, I call them, these Métis nationalists, want to simply eliminate about 2 to 250 years of history of that colonization and just say, oh, we started in the mid 1800s. In this place. well, how did you get there? You didn't come on a boat and boat right over to that particular spot. And if you follow it, it follows the lines of colonization, because as the colonists spread, then people moved westward, where, you know, to stay away, and more west, and until they covered the entire land. But so it's just kind of a silly notion to me to have this like geographic cutoff randomly.
Right. And again, I think it's, you know, shooting yourself in the foot when you are cutting people off, especially when, you know, there's strength in numbers. And if, you know, East and West could, you know, partner together on issues, just think of how much further they could go with the government.
Well, that's just it. And I think for me, like, I've actually seen families that have been, that are really affected by this, because some of the family is Métis, according to these people, and some isn't, because they live in a different geographic spot. And I'm like, yeah, but they came from the same people. Like, we literally are not plants. We don't come out of the ground. So,
right.
You know, it just seems so silly.
It's true. But again, with regard to rediscovering my identity, this is something with a native land, even though I'm not focusing on a Métis character, I'm focusing on a character who's Black Wampanoag. I wanted to create a role like her, because you don't see that represented in films today. Adam Beach, who's we call a native actor, but he's indigenous actor from Canada.
Yes.
He talked about that, how people who, you know, are not of native ancestry are getting cast in roles that really should be going to native actors, and how their stories aren't being told. His words resonated with me. And I wanted, because as a writer, I want to be inclusive. I want to tell different types of stories. I mean, I think we've seen enough stories about the sad middle-aged white man who, you know, where am I going to buy my cheese? The cheese shop just down, you know, closed down the street. And, I'm going to find that cheese again. I mean, that's boring. We don't need to see that anymore. The navel gazing. I want compelling, timely stories. And who better than someone we really haven't seen, which is a Black Native American cop. Many people aren't even aware of Métis issues, and I do believe at some point I will be writing about that someday too in a screenplay, just because I'm intrigued by, you know, the different types of stories. I think storytelling is so powerful, and with regard to this issue, I think we would all get further if we all just started listening to each other. And I think that's something that's been missing, is the listening. One side doesn't want to hear it because they have, I'm going to say this, they're going to have an agenda.
Yeah.
And, you know, your story might not fit with that agenda. So la, 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 I don't want to hear it. And I think that's a tragic mistake. It shouldn't be happening.
Well, I do too, and I actually really am intrigued by your screenplay, A Native Land, because I think, every once in a while you want to watch, just say, a dumb comedy or something, but there's lots of times where I want to watch shows where, you know, the characters are as complex as people are in real life, and nobody is just, you know, one thing. Everybody's multiple things, whether it's your interests, your identity, your history, your even your current family, your extended family, you know, like, there's all your blended families. So I think, you know, some of the more interesting movies or TV shows for me are where you do get more of that representation, like, of the complexities of people. And so I think that's an extremely complex character. So I'd love to read it and see how it, see how it works out.
Thank you. I do have a very exciting producer who is interested in it. So hopefully the screenplay will be greenlit soon and moving forward in production. I'll certainly let you know when. I will not use the word if, when that happens. But it's something that has been very important to me, is to make sure, you know, with this story, even though it's a thriller and we're hunting down a serial killer, I always treat my writing. Ernest Hemingway talked about the iceberg theory, that you see the tip of the iceberg if you're out in the ocean, but a whole other part of the iceberg like lurks underneath. And sometimes in a story, you don't even need to see everything that is there about the character, but it informs what we do see. And that's something I really tried to apply with the script. It's not a documentary about the situation for the Wampanoags. There are wonderful stories, books, you know, that are nonfiction. This is a great way through, you know, a thrilling tale to also educate people about, mm-hmm. you know, the very real issues of, you know, those who are, you know, Black and Wampanoag. How are they treated? You know, are they rejected by both communities, one community? How does the white community treat them?
Yeah.
And also about the land, which, you know, sadly now, I had no idea my script was about to become so timely. Who could have foreseen them, you know, losing their land potentially? It's tragic. But I think there are a lot of messages in there. Again, it goes back to unity, because that's really this hope in the script too,
mm-hmm.
you know, about, you know, unity, about the connectivity in the community. We have to be good to one another. It's the only way we're ever going to survive. And sometimes I think that message gets lost, you know, where we can become so fixated on ourselves and our wants and needs that we forget there are other people too. And if we just shared stories, people become more human. It's hard to other somebody when you know about them.
Absolutely.
So that's something I see happening with this, the Métis issue, is there's a lot of othering going on. You're not one of us. You're the other thing. And that's dangerous, to start othering somebody.
Well, and I think, you know, I think obviously it comes from a place of insecurity for people. Plus, I really think that social media, it's just way too easy to just be nasty on there and not have any repercussions in real life. Because I just don't experience that in real life when I'm talking to a human being face to face. I've never experienced that level of hate.
No, and I say this as a school teacher. You'd be surprised. Many students are lovely,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I teach in an area where, you know, from the outside looking in, somebody might say, oh, it's the inner city. It's going to be really dangerous and scary. The kids are great. Every once in a while, you'll find someone who, you know, through, gosh, you know, their past experiences or who knows what the problem is. They're not nice.
But
you get that anywhere. You get that in a private school. You get that in a wealthy community as quickly as a poor community.
Absolutely.
I don't like to other people. I do like to get to know somebody. I always tell my students, the one thing we can control, like we can't control our identity, like, but we can control how we behave. And you're in 100% control of your personality. If you're a jerk, that's on you. You know, you earned that. You worked at it. So I do appreciate when I get trolls on Twitter, when it's not an egg attacking me and they actually have like a real name and not like DJ Jazzy Jeff, you know, like something strange, you know, they made up, like it's an actual name. And because I'm always curious, you know, who are you? So I will click if somebody writes something nasty to me, like just on their, you know, Twitter, like, who are you? And I'll read through some of their tweets. And sometimes like they don't seem that bad. I'm like, why did I inspire, you know, the troll language from them? And then other times you can see that they're ranting with other people too. But you know, when I did, and forgive me for repeating myself, when I did share on Twitter that I was going to be doing this podcast, I got one troll, and thankfully he was taken down by some other people. They were very nice about it and very informed the way they did it, which I applauded. I was like, good for you. But I was surprised, because I didn't think I said anything that was inflammatory, just, you know, I'm going to be discussing my Métis heritage, and that's all I had to say. You know, Métis heritage was enough to send somebody over the edge. So I'm not sure why that was enough to trigger him, but it's a very sensitive subject, obviously, for a lot of people. But again, I go back to, you know, I'm not looking to take, you know, a scholarship away from anybody, jobs away from anybody. I actually want to create jobs through my screenplay, Native Land, you know, not just on the screen through the actors, but behind the scenes as well as possible. I mean, I as a writer don't control that, but I have very much made that desire known to, you know, my manager and the producer. That would be wonderful if we could extend opportunities to the Native community, because they should be involved. You know, if I'm going to be writing about a Native land, we should have Natives involved with this project. But yes, so I'm not looking to take anything away. I'm looking to create
absolutely
with people, you know, and again, if people took the time to get to know my story, they'd realize that's, I'm coming from a good place. The other thing I always say, I wish people would stop jumping to conclusions about someone's motivation for saying that they are Métis or Métis descent. Find out why they're identifying with it. Why are they saying that? And you might be pleasantly surprised. You're like, wow, you know, you're fabulous and you just want to celebrate who you are.
Absolutely.
Not looking to take anything from me. And it would calm the situation down. It's painting people with a broad brush. That's the issue.
Well, it's funny because I think for most people that are trying to reconnect, they're probably not aware of the politics of it all and the identity issues.
No.
I mean, I know I wasn't. And so when you're reconnecting, you really are just like, oh, man, you mean like I have some sort of tie to this really amazing culture and group of human beings. This is unbelievable. I can't believe I have this. And then the negativity starts coming in and it almost makes you afraid to even just say anything, do anything, be part of anything, which I think in and of itself is even a more of a crime. It's like, man, people shouldn't be afraid to go to an event or say they are who they are. That should just never be what they're afraid of, you know?
No, the bullying, it shouldn't be happening. And it's the immediate, sometimes vicious reaction that people receive that's uncalled for. Again, you need to know someone's story. Who are they? Where are they coming from? Why are you attacking somebody you don't even know what's motivating them? You're making this terrible assumption. And as I was always told, anytime you assume, you're making an ass out of you and me.
Exactly.
Don't do it. Don't do it. But, you know, I think it. Again, you have to question sometimes, why is somebody assuming the worst? I was also told it takes a thief to suspect the thief. I don't operate from a place of thinking someone's trying to take from me because I don't take from other people.
Exactly.
So when people start thinking you want something from me, what are you trying to take from somebody? Why is that immediately popping in your mind? I would recommend some people do some self-reflection on that. And I know that might sound really condescending coming from an American, but I say this to my students, to everybody, you know, ask yourself, why am I being so negative? Or why am I, you know, having a knee jerk reaction to something? And it's usually not the other person. It's coming from you. Like something's inside you doing it. And you have to ask yourself, what is it and why? And hopefully stop it if you're being mean to somebody.
Well, that's just
And again, as an educator, I always look at it as, you know, if I disagree with somebody, I don't attack. I try to take the opportunity to educate them.
Yeah.
You know, to have the conversation with them.
Well, yeah. And or to even to just understand their point of view, even if you're not ever going to agree, like there are ways you can just have a conversation and actually, even though you may not agree with them, you can understand how their thought process worked and they got to that idea or decision that's what they're going to believe in. Like even to just be open, you know, open your ears and your heart a little bit to just be open to these things. I think that's a universal thing. That's not and that goes so far beyond Métis. That's just everything. I think you should just be that way in general in life.
And I am that way. I'll touch upon the upcoming presidential election. And this is something I'm not ashamed to admit. I'm an independent voter. I don't belong to the Republican or Democratic Party. Some people say you're in the middle, you can't pick a side. But I like to vote for the person and not the party.
Absolutely.
So I have many friends who are Democrats, many friends who are Republican. And it's very telling with certain people when they'll say, if you're voting for so-and-so, don't ever talk to me again. And they feel that way, not just about friends, but family.
Yeah.
And I disagree with that. I think, you know, obviously, if you like somebody and then you find out they're voting a certain way, you're going to cut them off forever. Talk to them. And again, you don't have to agree with them. But why are you feeling a certain way? And discuss it. And not everyone's a villain. And so I like to find out why people are, you know, coming to certain conclusions. And again, you don't have to change your mind, but try not to be so disrespectful, you know, of where they're coming from.
Exactly. And just as a human being, I mean, you can be respectful to people and still disagree. And everybody walks away feeling pretty good about it. It's quite okay. So now going back to your writing, like, I mean, you've got a plethora of awards for your screenplays and stuff. I was going to try to list them all and I'm like, oh man, I don't have time to type that much. So congratulations on that. But, so why, I guess why did you purposely choose screenwriting kind of as your, I mean, as your probably your main platform of writing, or do you, like, how did it come to be that you started writing screenplays?
Well, you know the old saying, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. I literally had a teacher appear for me. I was moving from public relations into becoming an educator. And I was going through a mid-career professional teaching training program in Brockton, Massachusetts, which is another inner city in Massachusetts, considered kind of rough and tumble.
Okay.
So I was not allowed to teach. I was observing. The teacher did not show up that morning for a class. I was sitting in the back and all the students are filing in. There are about 30 students total. Wow. And I don't know how things are up in Canada, but when you have a sub or the teacher's out, the kids get a little rambunctious.
A little bit, yeah.
I quickly ran across the hall to a neighboring teacher to ask, could you call the main office? I didn't even know how to use the phone because it was a weird phone system. Call the main office to find out where the teacher is, what's going on, because I could feel in like 2 seconds that the situation was going to deteriorate.
Yeah.
She assisted me. We ran into each other later on in the teacher's lounge, for lack of a better word. And she asked what I like to do outside of work. And I said, oh, you know, I'm working on a book. I was working on a novel. And mm-hmm. she said, oh, my cousin's an Oscar-nominated director. You two should meet.
Oh,
and
wow.
When you hear something like that, the answer is always, yes, you're absolutely right. We should meet.
Absolutely.
So her cousin is an incredible Oscar-nominated writer, director. Her name's Mattia Carell. She was nominated for a short film called Cadillac Dreams. She lost to Stephen Wright, the comedian.
Oh,
So I can, you know, he's great, and he's from Massachusetts, too, so I can't hate on him for that, although I do love Mattia. So I did meet Mattia, and we hit it off, and she asked me, I love your book. You know, do you think you could turn this into a screenplay? Again, the answer is yes. I can totally turn this into a screenplay. I've never written one before in my life. So I run to the bookstore and I find, you know, Screenwriting for Dummies. That's actually the title. And
wow.
I also looked online for some other books and ordered the, you know, final draft screenwriting software. And I wrote the first draft of my screenplay and it was terrible. Terrible. And for whatever reason, she saw something in me, definitely not in the script, but something in me where she thought, I can work with you. And so it was like a master class where she taught me how to write a screenplay. And I just fell in love with the format.
Wow.
With a book, you know, you're getting into interior thought. With a screenplay, it's action and dialogue. So it's a challenge. And it's really a craft. You know, you have your first act, second act, third act, and you have to hit certain points in order for the audience to remain engaged. And I imagine, you know, if somebody was really into like writing a haiku, it's like that. Like you're just fixated on, ooh, I'm going to make this format work, you know, and get across my point in a certain amount of pages. So I love the challenge of a script, and I just kept doing it. I have written a book since then, so I have not completely turned my back on writing long form fiction, but screenplays just really seem to, I don't know, feed my soul, for lack of a better term.
Oh.
And I have done really well. This past year, the Academy Awards people, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, they have a screenwriting contest called the Nickel Fellowship.
Yeah.
And over 7,000 people entered it, and I was one of the top 10 high-scoring women in the competition.
Wow.
So I was very excited that, you know, I beat out over 7,000 people to hit that point. So my screenplay itself, Wonder Drug, reached the top 50, and within the top 50, I was in the top 10 of the women. So that was quite an achievement.
Yeah.
And I've won other prestigious awards within the industry as well. Wonder Drug was a Sloan script at the Hampton Screenwriters Lab, which is affiliated with the Hamptons Film Festival. You're going to love this word. This actually, the list is called the bitch list in the highlights.
No.
And some people would say I've been on it forever. I didn't need to be appointed to it. But I made the bitch list officially.
Nice.
And it highlights the best unproduced female screenplays. You know, female written screenplays. And so I was excited to reach that. And there have been some other honors as well along the way. So I've gotten a lot of recognition that has just validated this journey that I'm on the right path. keep going. Mm-hmm. Something that a lot of people may not realize is women, even though that we graduate from film schools and creative writing programs at higher amounts than men, there are fewer women directing, producing, writing in Hollywood than men. For example, I believe last year, 2019, 89% of the top 100 produced screenplays were written by men.
Yeah.
And only 11% that were produced were written by women.
Wow.
A woman has not won an Academy Award for Best Original Screenplay or Best Adapted Screenplay in over a decade. The last screenplays were Juno and Brokeback Mountain for original and adapted. And we know how long ago those movies came out.
Wow.
So, you know, the odds are against you as a woman. And the argument cannot be made, oh, it's merit. You know, you're just not good enough. You know,
yeah.
If you try really hard, you'll maybe you'll get ahead. It doesn't work like that. So there's a lot of discrimination. Some of the bias is unconscious, but I would tend to lean more toward it being conscious. Again, it goes to the status quo. If everything's all set for you, why are you going to let somebody else in? They might take from you. And this seems to be a theme in my life, doesn't it? It's a Métis issue as well. Like, I'm not going to let you in, you know, to my group because you might want something that I have.
Yeah.
You know? But so with screenwriting, you have to, as a woman, you're doing it first and foremost for yourself. You love it.
Mm-hmm.
And I will do it whether I get produced or I'm not produced. People cannot take that away from me.
Yeah.
That's something I enjoy doing. Would I like to be produced? I'd love it. Of course, I'm not insane. And I've loved to win an Oscar. I've had my speech ready for decades. I'm ready to go. I know what I want to wear. I know what I want to say. I know who I want to thank. I'm all set. So just give it to me.
Well, it's all about being prepared, right? You got to be prepared for that moment.
Oh, gosh. Yes, I would totally be all over it. So if that happens, you know, as I'm walking up, there she goes. She's got it. She's got it down. I don't need to bring written notes. It's memorized. It's ready to go.
Does it help? I don't even want to get into the ugly side of Hollywood with Weinstein and everything, but.
Oh, the Me Too moment? Yeah.
Yeah. Me Too movement was great because it got rid of him at least, but I think there's 100 behind him that need to go too, but. Does it help though? Like I've read, and I've heard about actresses oh, I can picture her, but now I just totally lost her name. But they started their own production companies, and they're looking for female written scripts and female directors and to produce and direct these female scripts written by females, produced by females, directed by females. Like, does that help at all? Have you noticed a difference at all in those kinds of things?
I have. Yes, I think women, and I'm going to throw in male allies too, because not every man in Hollywood is wretched. I've had some lovely male mentors who, you know, I must applaud. The reason why I have a manager is because of a man. His name's Stephen Nemeth. He's the founder and head of Rhino Films out in Los Angeles. And we met at a screenwriter's lab in Squaw Valley, California. And he just took a shine to my writing, and he saw something in me that he wanted to nurture. And he did this before it was even trendy. We met in 2013.
Wow.
So he's the real deal. And so he's been championing me for 7 years and counting. And my manager's lovely, Barry Crost, another man. The producer who's interested in Native Land is a lovely man. There are women, though, who are championing other women as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm grateful for that. It all helps, you know, us rise. Because the more good people stick together, it makes it harder for the rotten ones to do business as usual. It becomes very obvious. And I do believe sunlight is the best disinfectant, that if you expose the bad behavior and tell those stories, and it's so hard for the women and some men too, who have been victimized. They often get overlooked in the Me Too movement, but men have been victimized as well. It's so hard for them to come forward that, you know, I respect them so much for having the bravery, because a lot of times they will pay a price professionally, that even though even now in this climate, you know, people say, oh, good for you. Yeah, some people still don't want to work with a troublemaker, you know, or, you know, the person that they spoke out against has friends who are, you know, now angry. So that's why it's great that people, you know, are creating their own production companies, their own studios. It's not just women, but people of color are doing it too. So I find the women and people of color are really, you know, moving forward and doing great things. I think of, you know, Lena Waithe, Jordan Peele, like they're so exciting. Ava DuVernay, she's the director, and she's got Array, her company. And they're so inclusive and so positive. If you look at the messages they put out on social media, just the way they interview with people, they want people to succeed. Ava DuVernay, who I adore, one of her famous quotes is, you know, if your dream is just about you or just includes you, then your dream's too small.
Nice.
And I thought that was such a beautiful message that, you know, there's room for everybody. You know, if you're good, no one's going to take something from you. You'll just do well together. And especially the way Hollywood works, you know, one person's career will be moving ahead a little faster, and then someone else's career will move ahead. But if you're sticking together, you can help each other out during the times where, you know, the career is ebbing and flowing. But if you're just out for yourself, you're not going to get very far.
Well, and it's such an interesting thing too, because I mean, you think with Hollywood, and I mean, that is all content. There's 100% content. They need, you know, screenplays and scripts and stories. And so really to go out and find different, you know, parts of society, different people, different lives to get these stories from, I would think would be an imperative. So, you know, people of all colors, all genders, all, you know, ethnicities, all backgrounds would be welcome, you would think, simply for the fact that that is a whole boatload of content, you know.
Yes. And the numbers show that movies, you know, about women, movies about people of color make money. You know, if all you want to follow is the money, they make money. And actually, I believe I read a statistic somewhere that women with, you know, the female leads made more money than the movies with male leads this past year. So,
wow.
You know, if the bank is there, the money's there, why would you not follow the money? It's bad business.
Absolutely. And I mean, what it does, you know, when you go back to that, people seeing themselves represented. So like, even if your screenplay, let's say it made it and it got a big and it became a Hollywood success, you know, people can connect with that character, even if they're not exactly that character. You know, like we're saying, as Métis, you can connect to some of the issues that that person would face.
Absolutely.
So I think that's really important.
Just that desire. Like, you know you're good. You know you want to get ahead, but you're being held back by the system. Mm-hmm. You're being held back by outdated, you know, modes of thinking. It's frustrating. And a lot of times life can be, you know, death by a thousand paper cuts. You know, it's not like the big moments that get you. It's the little stuff. It's just that piece of sandpaper wearing you down.
Yeah.
And it takes a lot for someone to keep moving forward and to stay true to themselves and not give up on what it is that they want. And I think they can definitely see that in the character of Roxanne. Something I just wanted to point out, her name's not an accident. The Wampanoag, it means people of the first light. And Roxanne is a very popular girl's name for the Wampanoag because it means dawn, D-A-W-N, or bright, radiant one. So a lot of the Wampanoag love to name their girls Roxanne. So that's why I named her Roxanne. She's not just Wampanoag, but I'm acknowledging that it's a very popular name for that reason because it ties in with their heritage.
Wow. That's a really beautiful story. Thank you.
Yeah. No, I mean, I love names too. So, and in addition to researching my family tree, I love researching the meaning of names. The most laughable thing I found was the meaning of my name. You'll love this. And my father almost vomited when I told him because he had no idea. He's like, oh God, give it up, Caitlin. Caitlin is Gaelic for Catherine. And Catherine means pure. And I read somewhere that the last name McCarthy means love. So my name's Pure Love. And just go away.
That's so very hippie of you.
I know. You know, he totally did not do that on purpose. And my sister's first name is Erin, so it's Ireland Love. And again, he's like, that's an accident. I mean, they picked Irish names on purpose because he did want to celebrate. My mom was part, you know, French, you know, and Métis descent, but she was also Irish as well. Mm-hmm. And he's 100% Irish. And by the way, that's something else that drives people crazy. In the United States, when we're here, it's very rare for someone to say, I'm an American, unless there's a certain type of person who says that and you think, yeah. Oh, no, here they go. You know, I'm an American. most of us will just say what our heritage is. So, you know, if I'm hanging out with another American, I'd say, oh, I'm Irish. Mm. I'm French. Or, you know, I'm Métis, whatever. And then you'll run into people from Ireland who'll say, you're not Irish. You're a plastic. And this is a phrase they use. Plastic Patty. You're fake.
Oh, my God.
You're not really. And I always think to myself when they attack you for calling yourself Irish, like, okay, first of all, you don't understand. That's just what we do here in the U.S. We're not saying we're born in Ireland. We're recognizing that part of our past. But secondly, why would you turn away someone who feels warm and fuzzy about your country,
wants to
visit there, wants to spend money there? If somebody's messing with you politically, we'll side with you because we identify with you. It makes no sense. And I think of the Métis that way, too. Like, why are you turning away people who feel warm and fuzzy, want to support you? If somebody was messing with you, would say, stop that. That's wrong, because we're identifying. You know, why turn that good feeling away?
Absolutely. Absolutely. 100% agree. So I guess we're coming up to an hour here. Is there anything, I guess, what projects or something that you're working on that's coming up? Is there anything you want to tell us that that we might be able to see here soon or anything like that?
Well, I'm very hopeful that you will be seeing A Native Land and Wonder Drug very soon, because I have a producer who's interested in Wonder Drug as well.
Right on.
I am finishing. Yeah, I'm very excited. So I have, and that's something that a lot of writers go through, is that there's a lot of leading up to the big moment where the movie gets produced. And you sometimes will have people say, so how's it going? You're like, yeah. Still going. You're on the right path, but it could be, you know, it's that old ketchup. I don't know if you have the ketchup commercial for Heinz ketchup anticipation, like you're waiting for it to come out of the bottle.
Absolutely.
You're a lot of anticipation. But I am finishing up a novel, and I'm also going to be partnering on writing a TV pilot with a very exciting female writer from the UK. She's in Scotland, actually. So I'm excited for that as well. So I always have something cooking.
Right,
you know,
on.
When I'm finishing up one project, I have something else to work on. But the project I'll be working on with the Scottish writer is for TV. So I write not just feature film, but I write for TV as well.
Now, I had read, I did a little digging into you yesterday, and I read that you get up at 3 a.m. to write? Is that?
Yes. Oh, yes. Well, right now I'm not getting up at 3 a.m., which is glorious. I mean, it's terrible. Why? You know, we have a shutdown because of the pandemic.
Yeah.
The schools. So we're doing remote learning. But my school day starts at 7:10 a.m., which is a hideous hour. I am not a morning person at all. And I mean that truly, not at all. I found through, you know, trying to, you know, go to school, come home, take a nap, drink some coffee and write at night, it wasn't working.
Mm.
I find that if I get up before work at 3 a.m., it allows me, that's the first thing I'm doing in the day. I don't have the clamor of the classroom in my head. I can focus. Mm. And I refer to it as my morning pages. Something you'd be surprised about, though, I'm not alone in getting up at that hour. There are some other writers, and you see them on Twitter, because we always kind of check in, you know, that we're up and use the hashtag #amwriting. And you'll see that they're awake at some horrible hour. My favorite writer who's up at that hour is the screenwriter and showrunner, Brian Koppelman. He has a TV show called Billions,
which
is airing on Showtime. And I call him my Twitter friend because we've been, you know, chatting back and forth on Twitter for years. And I have actually met him in real life once. He's very nice in person as he is on Twitter. But I just like seeing that he's awake too. So even though it's a disgusting hour to be up writing, I'm not alone. But you'll be surprised how much you get done when you're a caffeine achiever and the sun hasn't come up yet and nobody's emailing you. It's wonderful.
Well, yeah, I would think at that time it's just silence on everything, right?
Oh, it's total silence. Even my dog won't get up for me. He just looks at me like, lady, you are insane. And his name's Oscar, by the way.
Nice.
I argue, I do have an Oscar already, but he's furry. Oscar wants a friend who's gold, who can hang out with him.
You really are preparing for that moment, for sure.
I told you, I'm ready to go.
Right on. Well, I really appreciate you coming on. And, you know, maybe after your book comes out, maybe what I'll do is we'll grab a copy and then have you back on just to talk about it a bit.
Oh, that'll be great. And believe me, what the subject is, I can totally talk another hour about that.
Well,
I'm a talker. What a shock.
I love having, you know, Métis people on from that are doing different things, because I think it's, you know, whether you're writing about Métis or not, or Indigenous or Native at all, you're still who you are doing it. And I think that's what's important. And so I really appreciate coming on and talking with me for the last hour. So thank you.
No, and thank you for having me, Darcy. This is a lot of fun. And, you know, I've been listening to your podcast and they've been very informative. And I hope people enjoy listening to them as well as much as me. Definitely check out past podcasts, because if you're someone like me from the United States trying to learn more about your identity, it's like a great way to do it. It's a great entry.
Well, thank you. And I have to say, you're welcome for your first troll on your feed there. So
yeah, thank you. I'm sure after this airs, I'm going to have more trolls. So please just don't be an egg.
Yeah, that's
own
right.
Who you are, and don't give yourself a weird little screen name. Like, just, you know, if you're going to be mean, just be mean. Own it.
Yeah. Own
Although
it, exactly.
I would rather people not be mean. You know, again, get to know other people's stories. And,
absolutely.
You know, if you don't like what someone's saying, you don't have to listen to it.
Exactly. You know, exactly. Well, thank you again so much. And I guess we'll chat with you another time.
That's great. Thank you so much. And bye, everybody. Thank you for listening.
I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. If you want to connect with us on social media, head over to our Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter accounts, which can be found by searching for @MétisPodcast, or can email us at metispodcast@gmail.com. Also, we have started a monthly email newsletter, so if you would like to get your email added to the list to keep up with anything new and interesting from us, please make sure to email us and let us know that you want to be on our email list. We hope you all have a fantastic week this week, and until next time, the jig is up.